Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners, all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Professor Patrick Newman. We've hosted Professor Newman before with Michael Saylor when we had a discussion of Conceived in Liberty. We had two episodes discussing Conceived in Liberty, a book by Murray Rothbard, which discusses the history of the United States of America up until the War of Independence. And I thought it would be great to continue with Rothbard's work with Dr. Newman, because as if you watched the previous one, you know that Dr. Newman is kind of like the voice of Rothbard living among us today. He's taken it upon himself to decipher all of the unintelligible handwritten books that Rothbard had left us, and he managed to get the fifth volume of Conceived in Liberty deciphered and printed after Rothbard's passing. He also did the same with The Progressive Era, which he's also helped edit and publish. And today, I thought it would be great to carry on examining U.S. history after the War of Independence by looking at two books by Rothbard. One is called The History of Money and Banking in the United States from basically the colonial era to World War II. That's a great book of essays by Rothbard. And the second one is The Progressive Era, which I find to be a fascinating book and with a lot of very important lessons for today. I think we'll try and discuss these as much as we can in today's episode, and the plan is to also have another further episode soon where we will discuss another one of Rothbard's books, America's Great Depression, which is an incredibly important and excellent book on economics. So we're going to build up to that history, the Great Depression, the era of the Great Depression, by examining effectively the century and a half that comes before it from 1776 up until the 1920s. Dr. Newman, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to discuss American history and to discuss the Rothbardian American history.
Absolutely. So I've said this before, but I'm going to say it again, because every time you read Rothbard, you're just blown away by the depth of his knowledge. I finished reading The Progressive Era a couple of months ago, and I found it absolutely astonishing that somebody who was alive up until very recently would write something so detailed, so thorough, so incredibly well-researched, so perceptive, and so astute in its observations on something that happened a century before. The rise of the Progressive Era was a long time before Rothbard, and yet he spoke about it as if he was there. He spoke about the election campaigns. He spoke about the way in which the votes were tallied and different political alliances. It's as if you're watching Fox News and MSNBC and people are talking about what's happening with the elections today, obviously without the kind of hyper-focus on inconsequential details that you'll get from mass media, but managing to sift through decades and decades of history while pinpointing precisely the most important points is absolutely amazing. I think it's I can't get enough of just saying how much of an astonishingly impressive scholar Rothbard is. And I'll say, I've said this for a while, and I'm going to repeat it again. I think you could say that America's best economist, best historian, and best political philosopher is one man, and it's Murray Rothbard, because I think what he's produced in economics is peerless, and what he's produced in history is also peerless, because there are other historians. I don't think many of them are as prolific as he is, even while he was doing all kinds of other things other than history. He was still also writing economics, writing political philosophy, and doing political activism. And yet his history is not just very voluminous, very huge, a lot of work. It's also incredibly perceptive, incredibly precise, and amazingly informative, and also very much against the dominant narratives that you would get from the majority of historians who more or less agree with each other. So Rothbard truly challenges you, because it gives you a discussion of books that you had not, of perspectives on American history that you'd not heard before. So the discussion of the Progressive Era is almost heretical for anybody living in today's universities. They'd find this to be completely absurd. Like, how could you say all of these mean things about all of these heroes of the Progressive Era? But Rothbard, of course, just goes on with page after page of savage takedowns of everybody who's ever wronged anybody in the history of the U.S. And it's truly amazing. And I can't emphasize this enough, listeners. I very, very strongly recommend reading Rothbard. He's a great author. And for all of the incredibly important and precise and dense information that he delivers, perhaps the most amazing thing about him is just how easy it is to read him. There are all these scholars who try and use big words, who try and use impressive language almost as if they're trying to cow the reader into agreeing with them by showing off big vocabulary and big thesaurus words. Rothbard talks as if you're talking to somebody in a baseball game. It's just explaining things very simply, very straightforward, and yet with these very simple words and sentences manages to build up massive, massive structures of knowledge and information and analysis, which I find extremely fascinating. And in these two books that we're discussing today, I think he does a terrific job of this. The Monetary History of History of Money and Banking in the U.S. is also an incredible, incredible work. So I want to let our guests tell us about it. So Patrick, what are your thoughts on this book?
Yeah, well, I agree with you completely. I think Rothbard was certainly a one-man army, a one-man army in economic thought, a one-man army in historical research, and one-man army in political philosophy. As you mentioned, I've learned an incredible amount from him. I would agree with you. I think there's, in terms of being greatest economists, or the economist who certainly influenced me the most, and definitely the historian who's influenced me the most, just in terms of my own research and publications, have been tremendously influenced by Murray Rothbard. And I highly encourage everyone to read his works. These books can be big, but he won. There's plenty of shorter works of his that are easily accessible. And also, these books can be found online for free, and there's also audiobooks of them. So they are very accessible. I agree with you. Rothbard writes in a way that both the average layman and the learned scholar can gain valuable insights from. And he's trying to present a story, he's trying to present a narrative of American history, whether it be of monetary economics and business cycles or the progression of government regulation, that is very much at odds with what you will read in other histories or what you will learn in high school or in college or reading in the news. According to them, everything before the Progressive Era was terrible. You had these really harmful business cycles. You had laissez-faire capitalism running amok, ruining people's money, impoverishing them, poor living standards, and so on. Then came the Progressive Era, and you see all of these enlightened government bureaucrats and other people looking out for the public. They passed these enlightened reforms, these well-intentioned reforms to clean up the nation's meat supply, to end business cycles through a central bank, income tax, and so on and so forth. And Rothbard turns that all on its head. And I think you could almost, in one or really two words, you could say it was the regressive era, according to Rothbard. It was a return to all of this mercantilist fallacies that had been so widely championed in prior centuries. It was just in a different sort of dressing, if you will. And he explains this. He was someone who spent a lot of his research output on American history, particularly late 19th and early 20th century American history. And we definitely see this in both of the books, A History of Money and Banking and A History of Money and Banking and the Progressive Era. And I think that you can read Rothbard. We mentioned Conceived in Liberty, volumes 1-4. We did that with Michael Saylor. There's also the fifth volume on the Constitution, which is a very, very important book. I edited that. We can cover the rest of American history up to the Civil War through various writings of his, but he goes through the monetary history very effectively, in my opinion, in History of Money and Banking. And then he has the Progressive Era book. And so he spent a lot of time on this, but it was only one of his research areas of interest. He's writing a whole history of the United States, which is quite incredible. And he's, as you said, he's leaving no stones left unturned. And it's really eye opening. And I think there was no historian like Rothbard, as you mentioned. He's able to write with such detail. This comes from his incredible memory. He's able to name names. And if you've ever read his historical works, you know he names names. When he talks about the harmful effects of a government intervention or some sort of law being passed or some bureaucracy behaving in a certain way, he always makes sure to actually name the people who are executing these laws or advocating for these laws and trying to show how they benefited. And in order to do so, you have to have an incredible knowledge of history, being able to gather facts that could be scattered all across history books or papers and so on. And it makes it all the more impressive that he did this before the internet, right? Before just simply searching something in Google and finding research. I mean, he wrote on a typewriter, right? He did not use a word processor. He wrote on a typewriter. And that just blows my mind. So I think he's absolutely something that everyone should read, and I'm very excited that we'll be able to go through his works today.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddine.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart,
to ensure learners can attend from all over the world.
I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with a nice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you don't need me to tell you, but it wasn't even a typewriter in many cases. It was with his hand. It was with a pen and paper, as you know very well.
Yes. The fifth volume of Conceived in Liberty, he'd hand wrote, and he had dictated into a recording machine. This was in the 1960s. The problem was the recording machine broke. Rothbard's research interest changed. Fast forward a little bit, he died, and the recordings were lost. But you saw the stack of, there's literally about 600 pages or so of a handwritten book at the Mises Institute, which houses Murray Rothbard's papers. It's in Auburn, Alabama, and his handwriting, if you've ever seen it, is messy, to put it that way. I have bad handwriting. But this was something else. And he sort of wrote in this this sloppy cursive in so many words. And I had to translate it. I decided to translate someone's handwriting in English. It was in English, right? I had to translate it. And that's what became the fifth volume of Conceived in Liberty, which I think is a great book. And it's just one of those, it was one of those incredible experiences, because you're deciphering something. And in this book, I think it's quite informative, because he really attacks the U.S. Constitution, which I think is something that many libertarians or conservatives sort of praise the Constitution as saying, well, it's a limited government document and it's a create a limited government. And I think Rothbard is far more correct. He's far more accurate when he says that it was actually intended to be a big government document. It was intended to promote cronyism or special interest policies. It was intended to promote monetary interventions and so on. And this is a very different history than what you learn from other authors. In Rothbard's analysis, which he'd only briefly mentioned in a couple footnotes in some published papers of his, could have been completely lost to time, right? But it was just, if not for this stack of literally this handwritten manuscript. So it's just incredible to think about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's not just that his work is impressive. It's just that it's irreplaceable. As I said, if this thing was lost, there was no other work of scholarship that presented this kind of coherent libertarian critique of the progressive era. It's just not something that you see very often. I think some of the modern Austrians, like you, maybe Thomas Woods, Robert Higgs, might have written on about that, but I think a lot of that goes back to building on the work of Rothbard, and we can't understate just how significant it was that he contributed this very devastating critique of progressivism and the main people in progressivism and the main ideas of progressivism, and to just present it and it isn't as if it's just, oh well, these people were lying, they said they were going to do nice things but they were actually doing bad things. It's a very, very elaborate explanation of how these nice words are, in fact, leading to very negative and very bad outcomes. So it's a highly valuable book, and I can't wait to dig in. So maybe we should just stop with the niceties and get straight into it. I guess a good place to leave off would be with the fifth volume of Conceived in Liberty, which we hadn't covered extensively when we were speaking with Michael Saylor. So what is Rothbard's argument for why the Constitution was meant to bring in cronyism rather than rein in the government? Why wasn't this a constitution that was going to guarantee us small government and protection of the individual rights?
Yeah, that's a great question. So during the American Revolutionary War, you saw two groups of Americans, basically. You saw were called the radicals. And these were people who wanted to secede from Great Britain. And you could say they were more or less libertarian. They wanted smaller government. They wanted to create separate governments and really envisioned the new state, so to speak, as independent countries, sort of informally allied through common, you could say, governing constitutions, state-level constitutions through common language, English, and so on. And then you saw the reactionaries. These were the people who were the most resistant to breaking away from Great Britain. And all they really wanted was just more representation in Great Britain. So they just wanted some representation in the government, so to speak. And then when America did break away, they decided to create their own Great Britain in the new in the 13 states. They just wanted to have their own British government with their own mercantilism, these special interest policies, regulations, taxes, tariffs that hurt certain businesses and groups and benefit others, and you know, strong military and all this stuff. They tried to get this enacted through the Articles of Confederation, which was the governing document created during the American Revolutionary War. But the radicals were strong enough to basically weaken it severely, to the point where the articles did not actually have taxing power. In order to get the taxing power to the federal government, each of the state legislatures needed to ratify an amendment, right? So you had this unanimous requirement that was, it really sort of made it hard to pass government intervention. It wasn't just a simple majority in a legislature, I say in the federal legislature. Fast forward a couple of years, we've got the Articles of Confederation in the 1780s. The radicals are kind of getting a little bit weaker. They're sort of getting distracted. The reactionaries are frustrated because they're not able to get their mercantilist regulations. They're still not able to pass a tax, aka a tariff, on foreign goods. The central bank created during the Revolutionary War, the Bank of North America, was getting weaker. It had lost some of its privileges from the state of Pennsylvania. In all sorts of other special interest groups are kind of eager for either a strong military or some other sort of privilege. A lot of people think that the 1780s was a disaster. It actually wasn't. When you look at the history, you didn't have states enact all sorts of tariffs against each other. You actually saw competition lead to lower tariffs and so on. But that didn't stop the reactionaries from proposing, say, an amendment to the Articles of Confederation, which became the meeting became the Constitutional Convention, in which the reactionaries kind of cast off any their stated desire of actually amending the Articles of Confederation, and instead just creating an entirely new governing document. So these reactionaries, Rothbard really accurately calls them nationalists. They wanted a national government, a strong national government in weak states. They just strategically called themselves Federalists to say that, well, it's not really the balance of power between the states and the federal government we care about. It's the balance of power in the federal government. You have the executive branch, you have the legislative branch, you have the judicial branch, and they will be able to check the powers of a big government. Of course, conveniently ignoring what's to prevent these three branches from working together and colluding, so to speak, which you could say happens in the modern world. And so when you actually look at the minutes, so to speak, of the Constitutional Convention or what's there, all of the delegates or most of the delegates were considered Federalists. They were not small government people. Those individuals such as Patrick Henry, he had famously decided not to attend the Constitutional Convention. He said he smelt a rat, so to speak, accurately, in my opinion. You saw big government advocates like James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Robert Morris, and they all wanted a strong government in their own ways, but they wanted a strong government to have greater control over monetary affairs, greater control over revenue, a stronger military, and so on. And they all kind of strategically advocated it through vague clauses. So the general welfare clause, the necessary and proper clause, the supremacy clause. They don't directly state what the government can do. And they say, well, if we do that, it's going to be too hard to get this thing, to get the people to accept it. Instead, we just say, Congress can pass all laws that are in the general welfare. This is a brief overview of the general welfare clause. And the proof is in the pudding. What exactly counts as general welfare or what exactly counts as necessary and proper is, of course, up to the people, the politicians, and the judges to decide once they're in power. So Rothbard in Conceiving Liberty, he goes through a really great overview that you don't get in other histories, describing how the Constitution really was not designed to create a small government document. It was designed, it was designed to create a big government. It was designed to create a government much stronger than the Articles of Confederation. And during the ratification debates, you saw the two sides formed. You had the anti-federalists, as they were called, who supported, they were against the Constitution. They supported kind of maintaining the Articles of Confederation or just sort of having separate confederacies. And then you had the Federalists, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, all these guys. And they really pull a lot of tricks to get this thing passed by these state conventions. And then when you look at what was actually passed in the 1790s, largely through Secretary of Treasury Alexander Hamilton, it was the old laundry list of the reactionaries during the Revolutionary War. But this time they were able to get what they wanted. Again, using the vague clauses, they were able to get a new central bank, the Bank of the United States. They were able to raise tariffs far higher than what they were under the Articles. They were able to assume all of the debts, the state and federal debts from the Revolutionary War at face value, which provided enormous windfall to speculators who bought them on the cheap in the 1780s. They were able to push the Spanish out of the Mississippi River. Spain owned it at the time, and lots of other things. And so this is a very different history when you see it. It actually is all linked together. The 1790s of Alexander Hamilton were not some sort of aberration from the Constitution. They were what they were the embodiment of what the Constitution was trying to do. And I'll just end with this one point. It was only through the resistance of the descendants of the Anti-Federalists, basically the Jeffersonian Republicans, Thomas Jefferson, that they strategically interpreted the Constitution to be limited government. They recognized they had lost. The Anti-Federalists recognized they had lost. So they pick up their baseball bat and they go home and they say, you know what? We're going to interpret this thing the way it was sort of promised to us. And that's where the Constitution gets its limited government interpretation, which has been able to stop the growth of big government somewhat, but not entirely, obviously, considering where we are in the present day. But it's just a fascinating history of the Constitution that I think a lot of people should read, because it really shows that the Constitution in many ways is flawed.
Yeah, I think this is something that might startle a lot of people. Generally, you see this among a lot of libertarians, that they constantly talk about the problem being that we are not a constitutional republic anymore, and if we should just go back to the Constitution. And here, I think it was Lysander Spooner, he said, well, whatever it is that you like about your Constitution, it's the Constitution that got us where we are here. So, and I think this is really the deep critique of the idea of constitutional republican systems. People just sort of think that, all right, if we all agree that we're going to do what this paper, we're going to write what we're going to do on a paper, and then we're all going to agree to do it, then everybody is bound by this piece of paper for hundreds of years. But, you know, pieces of paper can't shoot you if you disobey them. It's up to the people who are in charge of the guns to decide how they interpret it and how they interpret sticking to it and how they interpret whether it needs to be upgraded and updated. So, as you say, you could argue, I mean, you and Rothbard make a good case that this was from day one an attempt to expand the government. But clearly, since then, it's been very pliable. It's been very useful for that regard, in that you just introduce an amendment or you just interpret it in a different way. The Supreme Court will interpret it in a different way. And you see this kind of creeping statism that finds its way, regardless of what the Constitution says and regardless of what constitutional lawyers would like to believe it says. It doesn't look like it is a very effective way. Would you go as far as being a critic of constitutionalism in general, or would you just say that this constitution was just not good. And if it was done better, then things could have worked out better.
On a fundamental level, I'm a critic of constitutionalism just because I actually think that you could have, this is a whole different conversation, you could have private defense and private law, and looking at the actual history of law, in many ways it really originated through private arbitration and all of this stuff. But we can, you know, anarchism is for a different time. I think constitutionalism might be one of the better governments, but it really works best when it's on the state or the local level, and when you've got some built-in features that have less to do, I guess, with the Constitution, but more to do with the government in relationship, the power that the government has in relationship to other governments. So I think having a confederacy, the Articles of Confederation were not perfect, but I think it was very important because you actually did see some restraints. The government did not have the taxing power. It could only get money through by voluntarily requesting states to raise money. And that was an enormous restriction on its ability to pass laws and to accumulate power and to accumulate revenue. And in order for an amendment to be passed, you needed each of the state legislatures to actually ratify it. So if one state held out, it didn't get passed, which is what happened before with Rhode Island when a tariff was tried to was the federal government tried to raise a tariff, pass a tariff amendment, and then with New York, the same thing happened a couple years later. So this is quite important. Those types of features, those types of structural features in constitutions, I think, are very important. This constitution, when you look at what it actually sort of moved away from the articles, I think it you're taking away a lot of these roadblocks. So you're giving the government the power to pass a wide variety of laws, pretty much doing what it wants. Yes, you know, there's certain, the government has certain limitations. They say the Congress can pass laws. I think it's Article 1, Section 8, something like that. But that was all part of the strategy, just listing a couple of things. And the proof is in the pudding, or the proof is in the fine print, so to speak. But then, oh yeah, they can do whatever else they want. That's very important. And this type of constitution led to some serious growth in government power. And it was really only through the anti-federalists and then the Republicans, as I mentioned, that it kind of got its limited government interpretation. But that only goes so far, as you've mentioned, right? It what's to prevent them from then, you know, the small government people from then interpreting the Constitution in ways they wanted? And this happened exactly with Thomas Jefferson. He had a very strict construction of the Constitution, which means you read everything quite literally. And if it doesn't say that the government explicitly has this power, then that means the government doesn't have this power. And that worked all right for a couple years under Jefferson's presidency in the early 1800s, until Napoleon offered the whole territory of Louisiana. And Jefferson really struggled with this. He says, well, there's nowhere in the Constitution says that we can buy a bunch of land from a foreign government and then turn states into it. And Jefferson said, well, why don't we just pass an amendment after the fact, after we do it? But once you do that, then there's no constraint. And this is Rothbard's point. There's a great little pamphlet of his called Anatomy of the State, which goes into political theory it's a great introduction to Rothbard's thought. So if you want to dip your feet in the water, so to speak, start.
Maybe we'll have another episode on that one too.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll start with that one. I mean, you start with that one, read Anatomy of the State. And he says, what's to prevent the people in power from working together, from removing those checks and balances, so to speak, or from interpreting a constitution in ways that favor them and the special interests they represent? And the answer is fundamentally nothing. There's nothing to prevent that from happening. And that's exactly what did happen over the course of American history.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's time for me to again bring up my deeply unpopular opinion, which is you may not like kings, but you cannot escape kings. And all you do when you kill a king is that you replace him with 1,000 kings fighting over you, over who's going to get to rule you. And I think this is really what it comes down to. And constitutionalism is kind of presented as an alternative to monarchism, and to an extent, an alternative to democracy, that we just have this constitution and it runs. But ultimately, as we've both been saying, it's down to the people who interpret it, whether it's Jefferson or the people who came after him, and they're going to make amendments and they're going to decide how they interpret it. And so therefore, you're back to having somebody who's a king, because that piece of paper can't restrain him from interpreting it in a certain way. And then he has the guns and you have to abide. So as horrible and as anti-freedom it sounds, it may sound to have a king, ultimately, I still think the case remains that this business of government is a business that is multi-generational. It's not something that can be carried out at a scale of 4 years or 5 years or 10 years. You want somebody taking decisions today, keeping in mind what the consequences of that decision are going to be 100 years from now. And so for me, no matter how much you might find monarchy distasteful, because somebody gets born and they get to be king and you get to be a peasant for the rest of your life and you'll never be king, I'd still rather take being a peasant under a king who expects to rule over 100 years than being a peasant under an ever revolving door of kings who come in every 4 years and have no perspective of the future beyond the 4 years in which they are in power. And so I go back to the conclusion that maybe the revolution wouldn't have, maybe not having the revolution would have been better for freedom and liberty in the US. I still think that that is an underrated viewpoint. Not a lot of Americans mention this, but yeah, it was 2.5% tax on tea. Now you're paying, what, 40, 50% of your income plus all kinds of other taxes plus inflation plus all of that stuff. I mean, you could have just quit tea if it meant so much to you and you'd be a lot more free today. But hey, I'm not American, so what do I know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could certainly talk about democracy. This is a famous follower of, or a student of Murray Rothbard, you might say. Hans Hermann Hoppe has taken a very anti-democracy approach to governance and arguing that monarchies are better, or they're more stable. And we had a nice back and forth with Michael Saylor on that. I myself, at least, am not entirely convinced of the monarchy perspective. I think that the American Revolution was a good thing. It was a 2.5% tax on tea, but the British East India Tea Company was potentially give them a monopoly on selling the tea, and that could have extended to other stuff. But we can get into all of that another time. I guess I'd say that, well, the United States, for all of its problems, it's probably doing better than Great Britain right now. But of course, Great Britain doesn't have it still has its monarchy, but in all but name, you could say. But you know, so I think when we look at the evolution of government in the United States, when we look at Rothbard's analysis of it, I think what always blows my mind is how much importance Rothbard places on the monetary economics, the monetary legislation, and the monetary regulations, and the interventions, and the business cycles. And this is very important because, as another Austrian economist, Hans Senholtz, once said, money makes up one half of every exchange. So when you screw around with the money supply, you're screwing around with one half of every exchange, right? So it's a cute way of looking at it. And looking at the progression of government intervention in early America, you know, the United States had multiple central banks. The United States had restrictive banking charters on the state level, which was basically licenses in order to operate a bank. The United States, or the state governments, allowed fractional reserve banks to suspend specie payments during panics, which was really kind of a violation of contract. The United States would often pass some of its worst laws during a financial crisis or because of it, right? That's ultimately, we could say, what later led to the Federal Reserve. And this is just a good emphasis, I think, of Rothbard that really kind of opens your mind, because most historians, they don't talk about monetary regulations because without being mean, they don't really know economics, right? They don't really know monetary economics. Rothbard would famously say that the problem with economic historians is one half of them are economists who don't know any history, and the other half are historians who don't know any economics. And I think that's very true. And I think it was only through Rothbard that you were able to get someone who has who was someone who had such a deep knowledge of monetary economics, plus a deep knowledge of history, that you were able to see really the evolution. You were able to understand the evolution of government in the United States through the evolution of monetary rules and regulations, which I think is very important. We discussed this a little bit in Conceived in Liberty with Michael Saylor regarding some of the colonial monetary interventions. This plays a big role in Rothbard's fifth volume of Conceived in Liberty on the Constitution, and it certainly plays a role in the 1790s with Alexander Hamilton advocating for the creation of a central bank, and so on and so forth. So this is just something that I always am continually impressed by with Rothbard, because I think he's right. I think monetary regulations, monetary interventions more fundamentally, are so crucial to the growth of government, the growth of cronyism, and the all the harmful effects that come from those types of policies.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a good way to transition us into beginning to talk about the history of money and banking in the United States of America, Rothbard's first book that we're going to discuss today. So in this book, I think the perhaps the most powerful conclusion you can take from this book, if I were to try and summarize it in a couple of sentences, I would say, at least that's my impression, it's that for most people, they think of the U.S. economy before the central bank as being largely a primitive economy. Before the Federal Reserve was created, we were the U.S. was in this kind of primitive stage where they didn't have a central bank. It's almost like a country that doesn't have a stock market, or a country that doesn't have electricity or something like that. And that it was a free-for-all. It was the real free market. It was the Wild West. And it was because of that Wild West that all of these recessions and financial crises kept on occurring all the time. And the most powerful conclusion that you come up with, that you take away from this book, from Rothbard, in my opinion, is that no, in fact, in the 19th century, governments intervened in the U.S. banking system enormously, and in the monetary system. And Rothbard goes through all kinds of different interventions and how they affected money and banking. And the the strong Austrian conclusion here is that the good things about the 19th century were due to the fact that there was relatively more freedom, more monetary freedom, and more banking freedom. But all of the problems came from the regulations that restricted that freedom. And he mentions several examples of that. What are your thoughts on this?
So I agree with you. I think that's a very important takeaway to get from this book. So one, just to remind the readers, because I think it was mentioned before, the book is really just a collection of essays. And one of those he wrote, which this is, it goes through early American history up to basically about 1900, was an essay he wrote for the U.S. Gold Commission in the early 1980s, which Ron Paul played a part in. And one of Rothbard's motivations, one of the things he was trying to show, is that, well, it wasn't the gold standard that was leading to these problems. It was the government-managed gold standard or government-managed banking system that was leading to these problems. Rothbard spends a lot of time going through the first and second banks of the United States, which were the first and second central banks in the modern United States after the Constitution, talking about the problems they caused, the boom-bust business cycles they caused, Panic of 1819, and then later the Panic of 1837. Then he goes through the period of, quote, free banking, as it's often called, where we didn't have a central bank until about the Civil War. And a lot of historians say that, well, this is just a terrible period. You saw all these, quote, wildcat banks, and it was these fly-by-night operations that would set up shop in a town. They would print these banknotes, basically defraud their depositors, and then just leave, right? So there wasn't any gold, or they would take the gold and run. And they're wildcat banks. They were called wildcat banks because they're out in the boonies, supposedly, where the wildcats roamed and that stuff. And that's just simply not true. This period without a central bank in the United States history, which was, we could say, during the 1840s and 1850s, actually had some of the best monetary stability. The bank failures were actually relatively low, and the cost of those failures were relatively low as a percentage of total economic output. You saw competition, which actually restrained banks, credit expansion, reputation, encouraged banks to try to maximize profits in the medium term and long term, and not just in the short term by quickly defrauding customers. And the problems that did occur in this era, as Rothbard cogently points out, were due to government interventions, in particular prohibitions on interstate branch banking. So restricting banks from opening up branches across state lines, which really just kind of protected these little regional monopolies. A lot of younger listeners might not know this, but anyone who was around in the 80s or early 90s knows in America, there were all these small little mom and pop commercial banks that sounded all nice and cozy, but they were quite inefficient at providing reliable financial intermediation and being able to weather economic downturns and so on. And this was a long, long feature of the United States banking history, which is prohibitions on interstate branch banking, these various state-level laws. Other restrictions were that very often the state governments required fractional reserve banks to buy some of their state debts as a way of ensuring the value of their banknotes in case a bank failed. Well, they have these reliable, trustworthy government bonds that will be able to pay off the note holders. And in reality, some of these state governments were quite reckless with their own finances, which actually made those banks less safe. But it's just something that is so ingrained in people's heads that I think it takes someone like Rothbard and just repeated readings or revisiting of this, because this is something that is still... there's a fallacy that is still committed in modern day histories, whether it's online, on social media, on popular articles or new books, that, oh, well, life without the Federal Reserve would be chaos, or life without a central bank would be chaos. And just look at the United States before the central bank. And that, again, it's not true. As Rothbard points out, these problems were actually due to government interventions in the banking systems, the market competition in these banking systems actually produced a fair amount of efficiency and reliability that I think is not it goes unnoticed, unheralded, so to speak. And I think it's important that, you know, we're mentioning it and talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember I'm going through my old notes from that book, and I had a bunch of things that he mentioned, which were pivotal in the causes of the financial crises that were happening in the 19th century. As you mentioned, the banks had to use the state government bonds as their reserves. So the entire banking system was built on a reserve of government bonds, which is very familiar to what's going on now. And look how well that's worked out. You can see why that would be a problem. Instead of using gold as reserve, you're using government bonds. Government bonds have enormously high default risk. Governments are not very responsible financially and fiscally. So this can create all kinds of problems. The second one he mentions was that they allowed the banks to issue the banknotes, and the government accepted those banknotes as payment for taxes, which was effectively a huge boon for the banks because they could print money that the government was going to accept. So people had this extra trust in that money because it was accepted as taxes, which in many cases those banks didn't deserve. And of course, that led to bad consequences. And then the third one, there were all these usury laws about not charging high interest, about the high interest being exploitative. And so they would ban banks from charging higher interest. And so that meant banks had to give out cheap, low interest rate loans to people. And similar to kind of what happened in the early 2000s with the subprime mortgage lending, wherein you think, well, if the government passes a law and says these people are creditworthy, then these people just become creditworthy. But that's not how things work. You're giving them low interest rate. They're not going to become creditworthy. They're just going to likely default, and then that's going to create problems for the banks. And then, of course, there's also another one which I found interesting, is that the U.S. government set the rate of exchange between the dollar, between the gold and silver in the early 19th century. So between 1810 and 1834, the only money that circulated in the US was silver coin. And that was because the fixed government ratio significantly overvalued silver and undervalued gold. And so everybody in the US had the incentive to take the gold coins or whatever gold money they had and ship it abroad, because you could get a higher price for it abroad, buy silver with it abroad, and bring the silver into the US. And so the only money that was used in the US at that time was silver. And this is something that, in my mind, I think, I'm really curious about this whole bimetallism issue throughout the 19th century. And I think this was probably a historical mistake, because you would have rather had a big pile of gold piling up in the US in the early 19th century rather than a big pile of silver. And eventually the US would switch to becoming more of a gold standard country. But this was the exact opposite of what Isaac Newton did in England in the 1690s, I think, where he overvalued gold. And as a result, gold came flooding into Britain and silver went out of Britain. If I were to choose, I'd go with Newton's mistake. I call it a mistake because ideally I wouldn't choose. I would just let the two things float freely and whatever price emerges on the market emerges. But if I were to choose, I'd rather be in a place that overvalues gold so that we get more gold, because, I mean, if you look back then, the price of 1 ounce of gold was about 13 or 14 ounces of silver. Today it's closer to 100. So that was a losing trade, effectively selling gold internationally and stacking silver. But then we get to the Civil War. And then in the Civil War, of course, we get the mother of the 19th century inflationary interventions, and that is the issuance of the greenbacks. And what was the deal with that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so before getting onto the greenbacks, just want to say I agree with you. I think you brought up a lot of good interventions, especially the government accepting bank notes as payment for taxes. This was a big thing that the central banks, the First and Second Bank of the United States, were doing, as well as state governments. I just want to mention that one of the strengths of the Jacksonian movement, the Jacksonian Democrats, was after they got rid of the Second Bank of the United States, they instituted the independent treasury, which basically meant it was a requirement that the federal government would no longer deposit its money in a central bank or any bank for that matter, so no longer subsidize those banks. It would keep all of its money in terms of specie, and it would accept in payment specie for the in the vast majority of cases. And so this didn't give any unwarranted trust to banknotes. And I just thought that was very important that during this free banking era, we also saw this independent treasury, which I would say wasn't perfect, but that was probably the best federal monetary regime, right? Just have no relationship with the banks and just accept gold in payment. In Gresham's Law, money that's overvalued by the government drives out money that's undervalued by the government, or as it's sometimes somewhat inaccurately described, bad money drives out good money, definitely played a role in American history. As you mentioned, the right thing to do would just to have not had a fixed exchange rate between them. But the problem was the government was in charge of defining what exactly constituted a dollar, right? How many grains of gold or how many grains of silver. And this then led to various problems because the fixed exchange rate might not conform to economic reality, right? To just supply and demand of demand for those metals and also the supply or discovery of them. And this led to tons of problems. And the Jacksonians, another beneficial thing they did was they corrected that ratio, as you mentioned, where initially we were on mainly a silver standard. And the Jacksonians, they unfortunately decided to sort of overvalue gold, but it at least kind of moved us to that gold standard, which is a bit more reliable of a precious metal. Silver is good for small transactions. Gold's bigger for larger transactions. The best thing to have done, as you mentioned, was to simply just not have a fixed exchange rate and instead just have market monies. And we did see private companies mint gold coins, and they were known for their honesty and reliability, actually quite late into American history before the Civil War. Now, we get to the lovely development, I guess, of the greenbacks during the Civil War. This was during the Civil War. We can, you know, I could talk about this, but long story short, as Rothbard points out, in late 1861, the Civil War kind of broke out at the beginning of the year. In late 1861, The United States government suspends specie payments, as does Wall Street and other banks. So that means they're no longer going to redeem their notes and deposits and other financial obligations for gold and silver. And we remained off the specie standard, off the gold standard, really, until 1879. This is a long time, 1861 to 1879. And one of the things that the Treasury Department does with Congress's approval is they need to finance this massive increase in war expenditures. They raise taxes, including income taxes. They borrow a bunch of money, but then they also just engage in the old reliable tactic of printing paper money, right, with legal tender status that you have to accept. And this was green paper money, known as greenbacks, as they were later called, and that's really where we get the green tint in the United States money, to the extent we use cash, right? We all know it as green. And the government had promised that this would be redeemable in gold in the future. So it's really more of what Ludwig von Mises, a famous Austrian economist, would call credit money. It's sort of, its value is based somewhat on some future promise of gold redemption. But they were able to pass these so-called greenback acts. And fractional reserve banks, such as those on Wall Street, actually supported this paper money because they realized that the law would allow them to use this money as bank reserves. So if someone wanted to redeem their notes, the private bank notes, for reserves, they're off the gold standard. Instead, they could just give them greenbacks. And what this meant is that increase in bank reserves would lead to an increase in credit expansion by these banks. And this is, of course, something that Wall Street and other banks wanted. It's always a good business to be in, the business of printing money. And now Congress, they passed the greenback law in 1862, and they said, we're just going to print money just this one time, right? But one of the quotes from Rothbard from this book, History of Money and Banking, that always sticks with me because it's directly with this. And he says, printing money is a heady wine, right? Once you do it, you're going to do it again. And that's exactly what the Union did during the Civil War. They printed more money and more money and more money. And you saw very bad inflation. It wasn't hyperinflation, but it was significantly high inflation. And it wasn't as bad as the Confederacy in the South, which you could say more accurately did have hyperinflation. But this was a huge problem. This was the so-called inflation tax. Real income is redistributed from the late receivers of the money, aka the public, to the early receivers, the government, and its various cronies and so on. And Rothbard just goes through a great sort of overview of the greenbacks. And this is, we might say, is the United States government, its first significant, substantial step into the water of printing its own money, right? It had been involved in this during the Revolutionary War, but that was a different government. That currency had become worthless. It had obviously been involved in interventions during the War of 1812 and, of course, with banking interventions. But this is really the first significant step where now the government is going to print its own banknote. And, of course, these banknotes would later just completely take over. We'd have no more private banknotes. And the greenbacks, just a fascinating history. I will mention one minor point. It was good sound politicking, you could say, by the Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon P. Chase, who had wanted to run against Lincoln in the 1864 presidential campaign, and he starts printing his face on some of these greenbacks, right? He also prints Lincoln's face on them, but this is just, it's just good campaign strategy. There's no better way of getting your face and your name out in the public's persona other than having your face on the money. And this was an abuse that was rightfully considered just too much. It's a sign of a dictator when you have a living person's face on money. And so we later got rid of that. But I just love that little historical aside. You just see sort of, in my opinion, I would say some of the arrogance of government officials really on full display when it comes to monetary interventions.
Yeah, and I mean, once you get to look at a piece of paper with your picture on it, there's no putting that genie of your ego back into a bottle anymore. That's it. You have, your God complex is going to be through the roof at that point, and there's no coming back from it. But I'm curious, just this isn't really all that important, but you mentioned the green is when the green money came in. Were the dollar bills before that not green?
They could be different colors. So the dollar bills were really just banknotes. They were private banknotes. And I'm sure some of them had a little bit of a green tint, but they could be whatever style the existing bank had wanted. First Bank of New York or the St. Nicholas Bank. I show this one banknote to some in some classes I've taught where it literally has one of those old-fashioned pictures of Santa Claus on it, you know, from the 1800s. And it was, but yeah, it didn't necessarily have to have the green tin, but the green really became imprinted in the public's mind once the government got involved in the money printing business and then started to have sort of put the green tint on them. I'd also note that really up until the late 1920s, the actual size of banknotes, both private and the federal government's notes, were much larger. The modern size of the bill really came, I want to say it was in 1928. That we see that more modern size. But yeah, even though the greenbacks are long gone, we still, you know, some of their effects are obviously we're still living with them.
Yeah, another thing that I find curious when on the issues of putting people's faces on it is that Andrew Jackson is on the $20 bill, which I find, I mean, I don't know what the thinking is there. Was it, is it some kind of humiliation ritual to for the third bank to put his face on the currency that they issue after he shut down the second bank? Or do you think it's just he's a popular ex-American president and it's water under the bridge? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think he certainly was a popular ex-American president. I think now people would be all too eager to get rid of his mugshot off of the $20 bill. It's also just kind of funny because not only is he on a Federal Reserve note, he's on one of the most commonly used denominations, the $20 bill. It's not the $2 bill like Jefferson or the $50 bill like Grant or the $100 bill like Franklin. I mean, the $20 is... that's something that a lot of people use. So yeah, you have this president. I believe it was just honestly he was put on a note before, and then they put it on and on him later. I'd have to check that. But he was a popular president, and unfortunately, I think the history was a little bit lost on them as to Jackson's revulsion against central banking. It is a bit funny, I would say. And it's unfortunately he was able to get rid of the Second Bank of the United States and that we were able to not have a central bank for a while. But then if one of the other interventions in the Civil War that we could go through was the national banking system that was passed alongside the Greenback Act, the Greenback laws, where we created sort of a quasi central banking system. It was still too controversial to have a central bank, but the Republicans in charge passed a system of a new banking system where now you would have national banks be chartered by the federal governments that would sort of move away from the states creating banks. And these banks, the reserves would tend to be concentrated in Wall Street and in New York City, hence the quasi central banking system where those Wall Street banks sort of became miniature central banks, if you will. And Rothbard goes through a fascinating history behind this, talking about the connection between the Philadelphia investment banker Jay Cook and between the Secretary of the Treasury Solomon Chase, and showing how Cook was supporting this law because he had a monopoly on the underwriting or the selling of federal debt during the Civil War. And what types of bonds did these banks have to buy? Federal debt, right? And this is, it's just one of those great instances of Murray Rothbard really looking into the motivations behind laws and behind monetary legislation, where a lot of times historians, so they just kind of say these laws came from nowhere or the motivation was to benefit the public. And that's the complete opposite of the case, I would say, of what happened with the national banking system.
Yeah, and I think the fascinating thing here is for most mainstream economists, the period after the Civil War from something like 1873 until 1893 is usually considered to be a bad period. In fact, it's usually termed as depression, or there was a depression in the 1870s. And that comes down to the fact that, well, there was no central bank and the money supply was contracting after the Civil War. And so clearly there was a depression. And yet what Rothbard shows is, no, there was no depression. It was actually a hugely positive period in economic terms, pretty much in any way you want to measure it. Not only did output increase and quantitative measures of output and economic output, not only did they go up, but I mean, just looking back at that period from a qualitative perspective, that was the most innovative period in human history. From 1870 until 1914, I mean, I think all of our modern worlds invented back then. It was the most important period for finding all those new innovations. And it was an incredibly transformative period. And that resulted in dropping prices. And the fact that the money supply contracted after the war helped drop prices more. And so for inflationists, this sounds like a disaster. I mean, look, everything was getting cheaper. People were replacing their horses with cars. Think about all of the unemployment that you were going to cause in the car, in the horse industry. So clearly this should have been a depression. You know, people should have been starving in the streets and at each other's throats. Instead, we have the most positively transformative period in U.S. history, probably in the world's history. And this isn't just, you can get at this by looking qualitatively at the kind of inventions that came out of that period. In the U.S. and Europe, which were both on a gold standard, on the supposedly suffocating gold standard, yet all of the amazing things that we use today were invented, or most of them were invented in that period. But also in the Bitcoin standard, I cite this study, which went through a book. There was a book written with, I think, something like the 6,000 most important inventions in human history. And this guy, he was a physicist, and he went through that book, and he tabulated all of those things by their date. When did these innovations happen? The 6,000 most important innovations. And then he calculated that, he looked at the world population, and so he calculated the number of these inventions that were taking place per capita per year, and he found the data set of essentially innovativeness per capita historically. And you find that the period with the most innovation per capita historically was the end of the 19th century. That period, quantitatively, you can illustrate quite compellingly, in my opinion, that it was the most important period for human innovations, as well as just qualitatively. I mean, the car, the airplane, all these engines, all these incredible things. And yet, we're supposed to believe that it was a great depression and it was a massively destructive period. And I think, you know, whenever you hear an economist say paradox, or just not just economists, whenever you hear somebody use the term paradox in fiat academia, in my mind, it just look at this and say, this is something that, if you approach it with this approach that, oh, okay, well, this must be something that makes completely perfect sense and is just nothing paradoxical about it. It's just that this guy's worldview is broken. You'll find that it makes a lot of sense. My favorite example of this is what is called the French paradox in nutrition, where nutritionists have spent decades trying to figure out why it is that French people eat a lot of animal fat and yet they don't have high rates of heart disease. It's not a paradox. It's because animal fat does not cause heart disease. It's because you have a broken worldview where you think that animal fat causes heart disease when in fact it is the best thing. And there's the equivalent, which is the Israeli paradox, which is that Israelis don't eat a lot of animal fat. They eat a lot of plant fats, and yet they have high rates of heart disease. Well, there's no paradox in both of them. It's just your worldview is wrong. And in fact, this is what's becoming clear to more and more people. So you see this in this. This is another great example. The paradox of why we had a depression and yet people weren't feeling very depressed in the late 19th century.
Yeah, they're all great insights, I would say. I'd say shame on you, Saveddine, for not adhering to the food pyramid. If you were around in the 90s, we all remember this food pyramid saying that, well, most of them, your diet should consist of carbohydrates, and then the little tippy top would be meat and fat, and that has been sort of quietly discarded. probably because people just realized it was a racket for the big agricultural companies, the makers of cereal and various potato based carbs and bread and all sorts of stuff like that. Yeah, you make a great point regarding the so-called Long Depression, which was supposed to have lasted from the beginning of the Panic of 1873 through 1896. And it was this very long period. And a lot of economists would say, well, there was these business cycles, these harm for business cycles. You saw income inequality, you saw these monopolies and all sorts of stuff, blah, 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 blah. One of the important things that Rothbard does in both the history of money and banking, as well as the progressive era, is he really looks at the economic statistics and shows that, no, this wasn't the case. And just because prices were falling does not mean output was falling. Now, people would sometimes think that, but they would be suffering from a nominal illusion. They might see their prices falling or their nominal wages falling, the prices of goods that they're selling falling, but they would not notice that, you know, actually they were able to buy more goods. They were able to produce more, right? And the economy was getting better. I was very influenced by Rothbard's research on the Panic of 1873. This was supposed to have caused a depression from 1873 to 1879. The National Bureau of Economic Research dated a six-year depression during this time period. The National Bureau is still the same. It's technically not a government agency. It's a private business organization that still dates the timings of recessions in the United States. And the National Bureau is notorious for, once it makes its mind, once it decides a recession begins or a recession ends, it does not change its mind, period. So we have this six-year depression in the 1870s that is technically a longer recession than the Great Depression, at least the contraction, the recession phase of the Great Depression. The worst part of it was supposed to be from 1929 to 1933. And I wrote a paper on this, building on Rothbard's research, that shows this isn't the case at all. You actually look at the economy, and it there was a readjustment in 1873 and 1874, but in the rest of the decade, it grew. And this is something that would happen very often in business cycles before the Great Depression, and this is because the government did not intervene. It did not practice expansionary fiscal policy, racking up, running large government deficits. It did not practice expansionary monetary policy, trying to lower interest rates and boost the money supply. Instead, it allowed the market to reallocate resources from these sort of unprofitable industries to where they are more profitable, given society's savings rates and so on. This just continued throughout throughout the Gilded Age, throughout the so-called Long Depression, where really, again, the problems that emerged were due to government intervention, but the market, when it was allowed to work, it really did work. And I think it's just important because, you know, a lot of people might just say, all right, why are we studying this type of history? This is so far in the past. You know, how does this relate to the 2020s? But the only way we're really going to understand the present and the future is by understanding the past, because most people are going to say, yeah, well, you have this Federal Reserve. It's causing all this inflation and all these problems, but it's certainly better than the alternative. And the only way you're going to be able to refute that is by actually looking at the history. And this is something Rothbard did in A History of Money and Banking regarding the 1870s. He also talks about some of the industrial production in the late 19th century in the progressive era. And I myself, as well as other people, have built on his research. And it's just important to note that, yeah, as when you mentioned, when the supply of goods increases more than the supply of money, prices fall. And this is not some sort of calamity. This is not some sort of catastrophe. This is actually the normal feature of market economies. Having this healthy type of deflation of falling prices is what should happen. Instead, we're all suffering from the perennial inflation tax because the government prints more money. The increase in the money supply is greater than increases in the supply of goods and services.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the best counter to this also is just looking at the tech industry. Your laptop today is a lot better than the laptop you bought 10 years ago. And if you wanted to buy a laptop with today's capabilities 5 years ago, it would probably cost you many, many multiples of the price of the laptop. So you can buy the laptop of 5 years ago, you can buy it today for a fraction of the price. And yet people bought laptops 5 years ago. So you knew that you could get the same laptop. If you waited 5 years, you could get it for 5%, 10% of the cost. And yet people still buy it. And people keep buying that stuff and the prices keep going down. And the tech industry doesn't seem to be destitute. People aren't poverty-stricken in the tech industry. In fact, they seem to be making a lot of money, even as they deliver all of these goods that are dropping in prices, which also brings us very nicely to the topic of the progressive era and the issue of the monopolies then, and the antitrust laws. And there also we see a similar pattern happening with the Rockefeller industry and the Standard Oil, where they were being accused of essentially being a monopoly, but in fact they were developing they were dropping the price of their products. So the price of kerosene went down significantly during that period, thanks to Standard Oil, which was the leader in that industry. But could you mention, before we get into that, could you just mention the name of the paper that you mentioned that you wrote about this so that we can listen in the show notes?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's the Depression of 1873 to 1879, an Austrian perspective. I believe that's the name. I can send you a link to that. I agree with you. One, regarding the tech industry, it's a great example of the modern day. I also just think there's no coincidence that, at least for the longest time, unfortunately no longer the case, but the tech industry, prices were falling, was also an industry that had relatively limited government intervention. We think of early Silicon Valley and all of this. They intentionally tried to stay away from government, but now they're increasingly drawn into the maw, you could say, of Washington, D.C. And that's a whole interesting conversation for another time. I agree with you regarding the discussion of monopolies, because that's another sort of fallacy that is often sort of continued and perpetuated in history books, which is that, before government regulation, you had these exploitative monopolies that were raising prices, harming consumers, and so on. And we've all seen the picture, I'm sure, of John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. He looks like an octopus, and he's got all these nefarious tentacles controlling everything. If you haven't, that's an easy Google search. And Rothbard points out in the progressive era, and this is something that's very important, is that, in the late 19th century, we could argue that there were sort of two types of monopolies. One, monopoly as a term on economic theory is incoherent, but at least from historical analysis, Rothbard uses it. One were these monopolies, as you mentioned, like Standard Oil or the Chicago-based meat packers, the Beef Trust. They were gaining market share by improving people's lives, by increasing supply, by improving product quality, by lowering price. So consumers are choosing to buy their goods from Standard Oil because they got cheaper kerosene, right, for lighting lamps and other things, as opposed to people who were lighting or using lighting lamps from whale oil, right, which we would think of being very environmentally, the environmental certainly wouldn't like that, but Rockefeller never gets his just credit for that. So these were these, I would say, free market monopolies that were improving product efficiency. And bear in mind, even the Standard Oil never got a monopoly. Its largest market share was 90%. And then it kind of fluctuated between 80 and 90%. The other type of monopoly, we could say the quote, bad ones, according to Rothbard, these were the ones created by government intervention. And in particular, I'm talking about the protective tariff, right? A tax on foreign goods. And that what this would do is this would prevent foreign companies, say from Great Britain or from Europe or other countries, from selling their products at low prices that would undercut American producers, American steel manufacturers, American sugar refiners, and so on. And that these American companies, now that they had the government block out competitive pressures, this is a very important point in the progressive era that I'm sure we'll talk about, then they could collude, they could cartelize, they could form these large companies and so on. And these were sort of the harmful companies, but they were not caused by the free market. They were a creature of the government. Henry O. Havemeyer, this is a quote that Rothbard takes from, he uses in the Progressive Era. He was the head of the so-called sugar trust. Basically, they would take raw sugar and they would refine it, and that could be used in various products and candies and in cooking and so on. And he said, the tariff is the mother of all trusts, right? He's basically saying, look, the tariff is what allows businesses to collude or to monopolize or to raise prices. And it's because it blocks out foreign competition. It wasn't always successful, as in the case of the sugar trust. But you know, it's important to note that to the extent these companies were harmful, it was due to government intervention. This is just one of these important points that we keep mentioning in this podcast, that the market actually was quite good during this time period. And the problems that did occur were due to government intervention. It's just one of those instances where, again, we're taught something completely different. And the solution, the Republicans were the ones advocating antitrust, the federal antitrust law, because they wanted to keep tariffs high. The Democrats under Grover Cleveland were saying, look, we should lower tariffs. That's going to lower prices to consumers. It's going to weaken some of these tariff-induced monopolies. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. In 1890, we got the McKinley tariff, which raised tariff rates even further. And we got Sherman Antitrust Act, which at least gave us a vague sort of law that would later be used by Teddy Roosevelt and all sorts of other politicians to break up efficient companies and all sorts of terrible things. But it's just such an important point that I'm glad you brought up, because the Rothbard shows, especially in the Progressive Era, and I remember we spoke with Michael Saylor about this, that time and time again, cartels and monopolies on the free market do not survive. And that's just because of competition. It's competition, competition, competition. It's this perennial, consistent pressure of new companies entering in, increasing supply, lowering prices, improving quality, innovating through all those innovations that you'd mentioned that had come out in the late 19th century. And that's just, most people are unfortunately ignorant of this process. They think that the only way we get businesses to produce products that benefit consumers is through government regulation. And it's honestly, I would say, quite literally the opposite.
Yeah, I think getting into the Progressive Era, reading it was a very, very fun experience. It's a good book. It's a great book. I think some readers might probably not pay a lot of attention when he gets into the politics. I think the elections, he gets into it with such incredible detail where, particularly for somebody who's not an American, it's difficult to follow. I mean, he's got such meticulous detail where he gets into the the Norwegians of Michigan switching their votes in 1890 something from one party to the other, being emblematic of some grander shift in the Midwest. And it can get a little bit tedious, and it's a little bit sort of tangential to the main economic ideas, I would say. And I think there's a lot of very valuable economic ideas that I would recommend everybody reads, even if you glaze over the political stuff. So for instance, in the first chapter, he's got a good explanation for why cartels just don't work on the market. And I think he states it in a very good way, which I highly recommend reading. And you can find this PDF online for free. It's on the Mises Institute, The Progressive Era. And then he gives examples of the railroads, and he gives the examples of the oil industry and the steel industry. And in all cases, they were offering something that was extremely valuable to their customers, and that's why they were succeeding. And in all cases, they lost their lead ultimately because of market forces. In particular, in the case of Standard Oil, their advantage, their focus, their infrastructure, and how they built themselves was around kerosene. And then in the early 20th century, gasoline emerges as the more important product of oil. And so gasoline producers enter the market, new oil fields enter the market, new refineries enter the market, and the entire industry is revolutionized, and they lose the advantage that they had, which really only becomes a problem once all of this anti-monopoly state apparatus comes into play, and once it starts trying to regulate industry. That's when the Rockefellers, in my opinion, I think in my reading of this book, that's when they start being really nefarious. In other words, they were doing fine as long as they were just pumping out kerosene. But then once it got political and they had to defend themselves and they started having to buy politicians and get into politics, that's, if you have serious gripes with the Rockefellers, that would be it.
Yeah, those are all great points. On a side note, the Progressive Era is a collection of one. It's an unfinished manuscript by Rothbard of 9 chapters, and then it's a collection of essays that he later wrote on the subject. There's a whole history behind the Progressive Era, the book manuscript. I had edited this book, and I agree with you. If there are any chapters that you should read of this book, it's the first 3, and that's on railroads. And when he talks about trust, you see a lot of discussion on the economics of cartels and monopolies, why competition prevented them from really succeeding or being long lasting, and just a lot of great illustrations of this going on. And as you mentioned, for example, Standard Oil really started to lose its market share in the early 20th century, not because of antitrust, but because of it was just losing its sort of its innovative edge. John D. Rockefeller Sr. had retired, and the management had just gotten less innovative, less adaptive. So they didn't recognize new oil being discovered out in the West, out in Texas. They didn't recognize the shift of the demand from oil away from kerosene to gasoline. And this was really the big reason. I think, as you rightfully point out, most people would say that the Rockefellers, they were sort of evil when they're running Standard Oil. But then when they run the Rockefeller Foundation, they get involved in politics and stuff. This is when they become good. I think it's the opposite. I think really John D. Rockefeller wasn't perfect, wasn't a complete saint, but he was what economists call a market entrepreneur, someone who wants to make money by producing products that consumers desire, by adhering to the test of profit and loss and so on. His son and, John D. Rockefeller Jr. and, of course, his sons became much more of the political entrepreneurs, so to speak, which Rothbard talks about later on in the book, and we could certainly discuss. The chapters 4 to 6 on the politics in the 1880s, early 1890s are definitely very dense. So if you're not a political science junkie, you're probably going to get bored by that. I think Rothbard has a much more concise overview of this in A History of Money and Banking. I mean, in Progressive Era, he really goes into the weeds on looking at particular wards and the voting strength. He's really just trying to show the collapse of the Cleveland Bourbon Democrats in the election of 1896 that I think is fascinating, but I don't think has as broad of an appeal. And then the later chapters, chapter 7 to 8, go through largely the Teddy Roosevelt years of the Progressive Era and some of the antitrust cases he was bringing, and also great topics like the 1906 Meat Inspection Acts and the Pure Food and Drug Act, which is when the government gets involved, at least at the federal level, at regulating the food supplies. And people think that, oh, we need this to keep our food safe. But again, the market was doing good, and the market was producing safe food. The scandals regarding meat were overblown, or they were due to other factors. The so-called embalmed beef scandal was during the Spanish-American War. The military was just not adequately preserving the meat, and they were serving soldiers a monotonous diet in sweltering, very hot Cuba, which was leading to various problems, and the food was getting spoiled and so on. But these laws were really just instances of big businesses trying to cartelize to get the government to enact various regulatory barriers to keep out smaller competitors. And we see this with the Pure Food and Drug Act and with the Meat Inspection Act. And it's all just part of the same theme, the same sort of story, we could say, of of the progressive era, this book, which is that businesses, when they failed to obtain monopolies or cartels, long-lasting ones on the market, they turned to the government for help. And this is something that we still see time and time again up to the present day.
Yeah, I think that's a very good summary. I agree with you. Yeah, the first chapters on economics are very good. Yeah, the first three chapters I think are a must read. They're very good for understanding economics today. Could you give us a little bit of an overview? I must admit, like, I couldn't really follow this stuff. But what is the kind of overall picture of the transformation of American politics that Rothbard discusses in the progressive era in these middle chapters? He said essentially in 1896, American politics changed forever with William Jennings Bryan and that election. And it's just the nature of the Democratic and the Republican parties both changed significantly. And this was effectively what led to the rise of the progressive state a little bit later.
Yeah, of course. So, well, Rothbard tries to argue that the main question he tries to answer is, he says, okay, why did we get big business and why do we get just other special interests and so on advocating increased government intervention in the early 1900s? And more importantly, why did they succeed? So why did they succeed now when they hadn't been able to succeed in prior decades, more or less outside of wars and so on? And Rothbard's argument is that, well, for most of the 1800s, you saw a significant contingent of laissez-faire advocates or libertarians, however you want to call them, in the Democrat Party. Initially through Jefferson's Republican Party of the early 1800s, then more famously through the Jacksonian Democrats, guys like Andrew Jackson, Martin Van Buren, and so on. And then later through the Bourbon Democrats of Grover Cleveland, right? Where if there was sort of a free market political party, it would have been the Democrats, at least certain parts of the Democrats, the Democratic coalition, particularly in the Northeast. And in 1896, this changes because Grover Cleveland is no longer the standard bearer of the Democrat Party. Instead, it goes to William Jennings Bryan, who is a big populist, sort of a proponent of interventions that favor small businesses, unions, farmers. This is where we start to see the beginning of the Democrat Party that modern audiences are going to be a bit familiar with. If you were to tell someone that, oh yeah, the Democrat Party, Andrew Jackson's party, created in 1828, really, that was the laissez-faire party, and it's still the same party organization of today, of the party of Joe Biden, let's say. Most people would look at you as if you have a third eye, because they'd say, well, wait a second, that's completely different than what the Democrat Party stands for now. And the answer can kind of go back to 1896. So Rothbard, I think he has a very good question he's trying to answer, and he's trying to say, look, the progressive era was really facilitated by the collapse of the Cleveland Democrats in 1896, where now you just have two interventionist political parties. The Republicans, who have always been sort of the mercantilist party since Abraham Lincoln, tariffs, banking regulations, railroad land grants, all this stuff. And then now the populist Democrats sort of favoring this small-time cronyism, if you will, in that this new political structure, you don't have any laissez-faire political party in the United States anymore. This sort of leads to the progressive era. I think it's a very profound point. I myself am sort of building off of it in a book manuscript on cronyism during this time. I think Rothbard, as you mentioned, kind of goes into a bit of a tangent on this. And this is, I think, just him sort of indulging in some of his interest in political facts, political science. He was a self-described political junkie, so to speak. So he's going into a really, really in-depth, granular look at, say, changes in voting patterns between 1894 and 1896, that he was using some of the new political history of the time in the 1970s, sort of describing everything in ethno-religious terms that he was really influenced by. But I think it is a little bit too in-depth, I would say. You know, you could have maybe covered that point in much more succinctly in, say, maybe 20 pages as opposed to, say, 100, right? But, you know, so for readers, you can kind of briefly sort of look at those chapters, chapter 4 to 6, and you can kind of go into jump from chapter 3 to chapter 7. Would he have taken that out if he actually had published the book? He'd finished it. I'm not sure. As I mentioned, this was an unfinished manuscript. But of course, when editing the book, I decided to keep it in just simply because it's just such a fascinating history in its own right, if a bit tangential to his main thesis at hand regarding economic regulation of the progressive era.
Yeah. So in this period, also, the other thing that happens, major issue with money, is the free silver movement. And this is related to the politics with the rise of the populist Democrats with William Jennings Bryan, right? And so that force wanted to effectively engage in inflationary monetary policy. At that point, it was in the form of silver, in the form of the Treasury buying silver and trying to impose a specific price of silver, which was, would have required them to keep buying up new quantities of silver. And it was a time at which the price of silver was dropping. And so people who were on silver were not doing well. And this led to effectively something inflationary, which led to the banking crisis in 1893, right? The 1893 recession.
Yeah. So the silver is a fascinating discussion. We could go into this, but the Wizard of Oz is actually a monetary allegory. It's a story related to the gold and silver politics at the time. So the populists, as I mentioned, and as we've discussed, this is this group of, we could say, disgruntled farmers and largely farmers who were becoming more and more prominent in the 1880s. They had some legitimate grievances. The national banking system, which had been created during the Civil War, really favored the Eastern monetary centers over the South and the West in terms of the capital requirements, the amount of money you need to start a bank, in terms of the amount of national banknotes that were given to those regions. National banks were also restricted in terms of the real estate loans they could make, which hurt farmers. So they did have some legitimate grievances, though a lot of the farmers' sort of angst was overblown. People would mention, oh yeah, well, prices were falling, but farmers were indebted, so this was raising the real value of their debts. Not actually true. You look at the history, the debt, the deflation, excuse me, was anticipated, which meant the nominal interest rate on that debt fell. And farmers' income was actually rising at this time. It was just rising less than manufacturing workers' income. But that was partially, again, that's the Industrial Revolution. We were moving away from an agrarian economy to a more industrialized economy. So the farmers had some important grievances, some legitimate, again, once again, related to government regulations, but their attack on the gold standard and other things was misplaced. And so they had initially advocated greenbacks in the 1870s. Let's just print more of these. All right, that fad died out. And this all got tied in with this crime of 1873, where the United States sort of quietly demonetized silver. But you have all these populists say, hey, well, why don't we why doesn't the government promote the use of silver coins as a way of inflating the money supply, and it could be used for small transactions and stuff? The problem was, as we've mentioned, we were on a fixed exchange rate regime between gold and silver. And by what we were now starting to do is we were starting to undervalue gold and overvalue silver. So the dollar, the United States and the government obligations that could be, you know, bonds, or its greenbacks or later treasury notes, could be redeemable in either gold or silver. So it could be redeemable in a metal that was rapidly becoming less and less valuable. In other countries, particularly in Europe, were demonetizing silver. All right, why does this matter? Well, the United States was actually a big debtor nation in that we received a lot of investment funds from Europe, particularly Britain. And if we had moved to a silver standard, this was a partial default, if you will, because we are now promising to pay back obligations in a less valuable, less valuable metal, right? And this is worrying a lot of bankers in the United States, J.P. Morgan, rightfully so, worrying a lot of Europeans. And as the 1890s moved, you know, as the progressed, and we went to the 1880s, excuse me, progressed, and then we began the 1890s. both domestic and foreign investors became more and more worried that the United States government would not have enough gold to redeem its obligations, and instead we'd be thrown on a silver standard. And this would be, again, a default, which would really hurt the United States economy, both the government and businesses' ability to borrow money from both internally and from abroad. And this contributed to the Panic of 1893, which was, by all accounts, a legitimately severe recession. Traditional boom and bust cycle now tied in with a currency crisis. And it was so severe because we never really, we weren't able to convince people that we were actually going to stay on the gold standard and this was going to be credible, because the populists were gaining more and more strength in the Democrat Party. Where by 1896, as Rothbard explains, William Jennings Bryan was the Democrat candidate. He was in favor of silver. And William McKinley, who was the Republican candidate, he was also in favor of silver. The Republicans had a significant faction of sort of being a soft money or inflationist people, inflationist politicians. And you saw both the Republicans and the Democrats, in a sense, now partially repudiating the gold standard, which was really, really worrying for investors. And so this led to this famous meeting where J.P. Morgan meets with Mark Hanna, who is sort of engineering William McKinley's campaign. They have this big meeting on J.P. Morgan's yacht, which is just, you just have great images, sort of a yacht was called the Corsair, and you just see this big sort of meeting of the bosses, so to speak. And this is Morgan basically gets Mark Hanna and McKinley to agree to support the gold standard. In return, Morgan and Wall Street and the rest of big business will support McKinley. And this is exactly what happens, and McKinley wins, and the populist menace is sort of defeated, but you don't have a laissez-faire party anymore. The Cleveland Democrats are long gone, and the Republicans are sort of the vehicle in which big business will be able to pass their various crony policies during the Progressive Era. Yeah, but silver politics, fascinating. You could have a whole podcast on this in and of itself. Really, after with the Gold Standard Act of 1900, the silver issue more or less died in American politics. But silver was very, very important in American politics in the 1880s and the 1890s.
Yeah, having written about this in the Bitcoin Standard and followed it over the last few years and thought about it more and more, a part of me thinks of silver as essentially the original shitcoinery. It's got undertones. It's very similar to what's going on with shitcoins, in that the market all over the world is coalescing around gold as money for a very good reason, which is that gold is harder than silver. It's harder to make gold than silver. The supply of gold increases at around 1% to 2% per year, whereas for silver, it's maybe 5, 6, 7% around that time. Nobody's really sure. But you would expect that this would just be the force of economic incentive would drive people toward that. And yet, people just want more money. And so for a lot of people in America, and I can see why, because, you know, from 1800 to 1830, as we were mentioning earlier, a lot, you know, the U.S. was running on silver and gold was leaving the country. So there was a lot of silver. The U.S. was heavily invested in holding all these silver bags. Essentially, a lot of people had a good reason to go out and shill that shitcoin, basically, mm-hmm. because they'd inherited bags from their parents and from their grandparents, because this is the only money that the country had had for a while up until the 1830s when gold started coming back. So because of this, I've always wondered, if we hadn't had all of that stuff around silver, and if we'd had some kind of high-tech modernization of the gold-based banking system that allowed gold to exist with more trust without central banks being able to mess with it as much, I think what could have happened might have been a massive appreciation in the price of gold and a very fast depreciation in the price of silver. And effectively, this would have led to a much more efficient monetary system that eventually everybody went on gold. But it would have been something like a massive appreciation of gold. And I think perhaps it's only because we didn't have that massive appreciation in the price of gold because governments were managing the gold standard. That's effectively what allowed that enormous surplus that governments were able to spend, which was a function of the increased productivity of industrialization. Rather than it manifesting in massive hyperdeflation in the sense of the price of gold going up and all other monies getting demonetized and everything flowing into gold and everything becoming cheaper because of all of the increased productivity that we are able to harness because we are utilizing a hard money that is holding on to value and because the money is appreciating, so people become more likely to save, so people develop a lower time preference. All of that combined would have led to a massive increase in living standards. And in a sense, by managing that and switching it to switching to a government credit-based standard, governments were able to effectively appropriate all of that surplus. This is how I kind of think about it, and that they then went and spent it all on world wars and murdering hundreds of millions of people. And instead, we should have just accepted and had the price of gold go up against everything, and maybe we would have had a very different history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's a good point. When I was describing the silver, I was honestly thinking of the Bitcoin to shitcoin analogy, but I didn't bring it up. I'm glad you did. The one thing that you're in a sense I didn't mention that is sort of explains this is one of the major special interests that were one financing the populace, but of course were in favor of the remonetization of silver were of course none other than the silver miners, the silver mine owners. So you saw some quite wealthy people out in Montana, out in Nevada, out in those areas where you saw some silver mines. And yeah, they were financing William Jennings Bryan and stuff. So those were the makers of those shit coins, as you mentioned, maybe, you know, again, where's the interest it comes from? Again, who's creating the money, right? Of course, if the United States won a silver standard, this would be a huge benefit to people who mine silver out of the ground, because silver is, of course, used in not just in various industrial purposes, but in would be used potentially for money. Yeah, and it is unfortunate. The market value of gold was rising relative to silver during this time, but it was that fixed exchange rate. It was the insistence of the United States government to define the dollar in terms of both gold and silver and to not adjust that fixed exchange rate when the market ratio fluctuated, that you saw this problem. And this led to, of course, a very nasty a business cycle downturn in the 1890s. Grover Cleveland, the Clevelandite Democrats, who for all their flaws, they were relatively limited government. And they were, you know, they get a thumbs up in my book. They lose their power. Yeah. And then we see of course, the Progressive Era and later monetary interventions with the Federal Reserve and so on. And yeah, if only we had just stayed on a gold standard, or more accurately, a more I guess even better, a market based gold standard, would we maybe we would have avoided some of these problems. Silver did serve its purpose back in the day when for small transactions. Right, silver coins would be better, but especially as the century progressed, they moved away from actually using coins to instead just using banknotes or deposits that would then be redeemable in those coins. That advantage of silver as opposed to gold would really kind of decline. Right, whenever you know people would be talking about a gold standard or Murray Rothbard, he obviously didn't have Bitcoin or anything like that. He would never say, "Oh yeah, going to the grocery store, you'd use a gold coin." It would be, of course, in paper money that was redeemable in gold, right? Something like that. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that point up. It is a good way of mentioning, yeah, the silver mine owners, and they were one of the main backers of this whole thing. Naturally, I guess you could say.
Yeah, but I mean, just like today in the digital version, there was the miners and the producers, you know, the people who made the shitcoin. But also there's the bag holders. There's the people who had lumps of silver inherited. And they thought by voting, we can we can keep the price going up. And I think eventually this basically came to an end in 1893, I would say. Would that be accurate?
The silver issue, I would say, Grover Cleveland in that year was able to muscle through repeal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act of 1890, which was one of the laws that was worrying investors. The silver issue did not really get fully settled until 1896, when McKinley beats Bryan, and then ultimately until 1900, when Congress passes a law, I think it was called the Gold Standard Act, just basically saying, yeah, we're on the gold standard, right? Like just an extra sort of reassurance. But yeah, silver was very, very, very prominent issue in the 1880s and 1890s. And of course, the effects of that are ultimately still with us.
Yeah. Now, then at that point, McKinley becomes president. And then that leads to the rise of Teddy Roosevelt, whom Rothbard calls the first progressive president. And he plays a very important role in the advance of progressivism. So can you tell us more about the rise of Teddy Roosevelt and how fishy is it?
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt was definitely not one of Rothbard's favorite presidents, and he's certainly not mine. You can make the argument that he was a couple screws missing in the head. He one time gave a speech in like 1910 and someone shot him and he had a bullet in his stomach and the assailant got taken away, but he continued speaking, right? So that there's something. He continued to give his speech, right? But Teddy Roosevelt, he wasn't McKinley's original vice president, but he was put on the ticket in 1900. He was a sort of progressive governor of New York who then became president after McKinley got shot in September 1901. And something to note about Roosevelt is, so since up to that point, the vice president position in United States politics was sort of a dead end position. It wasn't like today where the vice president is a potential stepping stone to the presidency. Vice president, it was like the political graveyard. Once you do that, you don't become president. The only way you could do that is if the president who you're working for dies. And before Roosevelt, no vice president who had become president after the original president died had won re-election. So Roosevelt was very, very paranoid about this. He really wanted to win re-election in 1904. He really wanted to establish himself. And so he was doing things that he thought would curry him a lot of political favor, going after Northern Securities, this railroad company with antitrust. Of course, then later passing all of this food and drug acts. I mean, this happened after his presidency, but he was someone who kind of transformed the presidency, sort of supercharged the executive. And a lot of his actions, you could say, ended up supporting these large companies such as those affiliated with J.P. Morgan and Company. He had the good trusts and the bad trusts, but it just so happened that all of the good trusts were basically Morgan companies, those affiliated with the investment bank of J.P. Morgan and Company, whereas the bad trusts were trusts associated with the Beef Trust, Rockefeller, and Standard Oil, and so on. And this is just a part of history most Americans don't really know. And you think of Roosevelt as being this great president. I think his antitrust cases did not help economic growth. They harmed efficiency. I think his food and drug regulations were equally harmful. I think his conservation, his environmental crusades did not help. And I think he was the beginning of the quote, regressive era, which I think is a more accurate way of putting it, where we're sort of moving backwards. The United States is losing all sort of links or vestiges, whatever you want to call it, to laissez-faire, at least relatively free market. And we're sort of accelerating into Roosevelt, into Taft, into Wilson, who was really a terrible president, of course, with the Federal Reserve and World War One and the income tax and all this stuff. So then we start to get into the era of the really bad presidents, you could say.
Yeah. No, I think that's very correct. I think it's obviously very influential, specifically in the starting of the Federal Reserve. I think you see the trend develop. And one of the valuable things about reading this book, The Progressive Era, is that you see this kind of cartelization develop across industries. And then you see how it was going to eventually make it into banking. And you see how effectively there's this romantic idea that for most people that it is the government that's out there against these awful criminal corporations that would be out there killing people if it wasn't for the government to restrain them. But once you look under the veneer of what is really going on, it becomes clear that it's essentially turf wars between different organizations utilizing the state and fighting for the state and utilizing different arms for the state against each other. So in particular, it seems that Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt in particular, and we're talking here, and this is the early 20th century, he was helpful to the Morgan interest. And they had gone after Rockefeller. And so effectively, the Sherman Act, I think it was called, where with which they went after Rockefeller, that was a pivotal moment in business history because that was never really done against a business before. And it forced the breakdown of Standard Oil and changed things around. But that suggests that, you know, this is a lot less romantic than people would like to understand. It's just the same kind of corrupt politics that you discover about your politicians these days. It's just happening a lot earlier.
Oh, I agree with you completely. Roosevelt had viciously gone after Standard Oil. He'd always hated Standard Oil because he had thought they were responsible for people trying to oust him from New York state politics. And then they had Standard Oil had, unlike the Morgans, had engaged in the disastrous, you know, position, I would say, of not supporting Roosevelt's signature corporation regulation, which is to create a Department of Commerce and Labor with a Bureau of Corporations to investigate these companies. And so Roosevelt very matter-of-factly stated, oh, yeah, now I'm just going to go after these guys. Screw them. Screw Standard Oil. And he was trying to fine them for violating the Elkins Anti-Rebating Act. I think they got a $29 million fine, which was at the time a huge fine. There was a very famous quote from the American author Mark Twain. And he said, I'm going to quote the bride the night of her wedding. And he says, I knew it was coming, but I didn't suppose it would be so big. And he was talking about this $29 million fine, and that eventually got dropped. And then Roosevelt went to just basically simply broke up the company through antitrust. And yeah, this was a huge, tack. It showed the supremacy of the federal government over the market, and that the federal government ultimately, again, with the right people in charge, interpreting the right things, the government decides how big you get to be, whether you get to exist or not. And this was a big moment because Roosevelt, the Sherman Antitrust Act had been kind of like a dead letter in the 1890s as intended. Big business didn't want to actually be used. But then Roosevelt starts interpreting it in ways and has a very expansive view of what counts as a restraint of trade. And this is the Sherman Antitrust Act. This is antitrust that we have to live with. And with that came the Federal Trade Commission and all this stuff. And you read about these government agencies still today, and all sorts of problems, and they're attacking of big tech and all this stuff. And I mean, it's history. History doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes, you could say.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about that period, but I did find it fishy how Teddy Roosevelt made it to the presidency, because he was not elected the first time. Several accidents, very unfortunate accidents that happened. So basically, the vice president of President McKinley died in 1899. And then McKinley went out looking for a vice president, and he offered it to four different people. And all those people said no, they didn't want to take it. And then he took Teddy Roosevelt, even though he wasn't very keen on him. But McKinley was also kind of friendly with the Morgans. The Morgans really wanted Teddy Roosevelt. And so McKinley eventually, after his first four choices, said no. He went for Plan E and gave it to Teddy Roosevelt. And then McKinley gets shot. And then Teddy Roosevelt becomes president. So it's, I mean, four no's, fifth choice vice president, or sixth choice, because there was a dead vice president, and then four others. So sixth choice vice president, and then the president gets killed. I mean, maybe I'm just too paranoid, but I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's certainly a fortunate for Roosevelt, because a lot of people didn't want him, and they, you know, they had initially sort of some people who were sponsoring him to be vice president just simply wanted him out of New York, and they wanted him out of the governor. He was governor of New York at the time, and they wanted to kick him out. They had enough troubles with him, but Mark Hanna, who was sort of McKinley's main strategist, was adamantly against Roosevelt, because he said, can't you see this madman is only one heartbeat away from the presidency? Basically saying that, look, all it takes is McKinley to die, and now you've got this guy as the president. And that is exactly what happened, right? And at this point, everyone's going, oh, you know, what do we do, right? That thing. But yeah, it is, it's sometimes you just got to be the right place.
Everyone but the Morgans. Yeah. Everyone but the Morgans. I'm sure they weren't going, oh, no. I mean, I'm sure they were pretty happy about it.
At least George Perkins and some other Morgan partners who knew Roosevelt were certainly, you know, at least not as upset as other people. And you know, Rothbard argues that Roosevelt was a big sort of very pro Morgan, and the Morgans are very pro Roosevelt. I think it's a bit more nuanced than that. Okay. And I'm sort of working on this in my own book. I think they supported some of the stuff he was doing, but Roosevelt did cause some headaches for J.P. Morgan, especially early on. But there was a lot of what's known as shadow boxing, right, where these guys say they hate each other, but they don't really hate each other. They maybe just kind of dislike each other. Lots of things to sort of disentangle. But definitely Roosevelt, not one of my favorite presidents. And it's just something about the Roosevelt name, because FDR was bad. He was worse, I guess you could say. It's unfortunate. Imagine if McKinley never died. I thought McKinley wasn't a great president, but he wasn't as bad as, I guess I would say, Roosevelt. What are you going to do? You know, it's so history goes, right?
Yeah. I mean, you've got the Federal Reserve now. So pretty fortuitous accident, I guess.
Which Rothbard also talks a lot about in America's Great Depression, that I hope we'll get into at some point in the future.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is a great lead up to the Great Depression. So we're working our way up right now. So now we arrive effectively at the turn of the 20th century. This is when this amazing movie of the 19th century gets this incredible sequel of the 20th century, which starts off effectively by the establishment of the Federal Reserve and World War I, which is kind of a big deal. And then there's that leads to the inflationary policies going off the gold standard, inflation in the 1920s, and then a depression in the 1930s. But I think we've probably used enough of your time for today. I think we could leave all of this for the next discussion, where we will talk about that and the Federal Reserve and the Great Depression, which is, in my opinion, maybe my favorite Rothbard book, I would say. And it's a great book, America's Great Depression. So I really look forward to discussing it with you.
Absolutely. I look forward to it as well. I got my copy right here right now. But yeah, I agree. It's the discussion of the Federal Reserve, discussion of the Great Depression, extremely important. So it's something we should do at some point in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you again so much for your time, Patrick.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers. Take care.